You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity.
Welcome. Today, we are deep diving into really one of the most critical scenarios we face as perioperative clinicians.
And that's managing a patient with known aortic stenosis AS who's coming in for non-cardiac surgery.
Exactly. This is where, you know, high-stakes physiology really meets tactical, practical planning. It's a big one.
That is absolutely our mission today. We want to take these complex echo reports, all those numbers, and translate them into something simple, high yield, and actionable.
Yeah, we need to get past just like reciting the criteria. We need to understand the why we make the choices we do.
So to kick that off, we need the core analogy, right? Because AS is fundamentally, well, it's a mechanical problem.
It really is. You have to visualize the risk. You know, every single time you open that patient's chart, it helps frame everything.
Okay, so let's paint that picture. Visualize the aortic valve, that main exit door from the heart's primary pump.
The left ventricle, yeah.
Think of it like a busy exit ramp on a major highway. Normally, it's wide, flexible, traffic flows smoothly, high volume.
But with aortic stenosis, that ramp is narrowed. It's rigid, calcified. It's basically become a fixed one-lane bottleneck.
And crucially, it's a fixed outflow obstruction. That's the key term.
Absolutely. You can't dynamically widen that ramp during the surgery. What you see is what you get.
And the left ventricle, the engine trying to push all that blood, all that traffic through this tiny opening, it adapts, but not in a good way long term.
Right. It doesn't just work harder. It actually changes its structure. It bulks up, gets thicker, stiffer. That's what we call concentric hypertrophy.
So it becomes this incredibly powerful muscle, but it's also rigid and really oxygen hungry because of all that muscle mass.
And that's the core problem physiologically. The heart's generating huge pressure inside, but it cannot increase its stroke volume, the amount of blood pushed out per beat, to compensate for anything.
It's running right at the edge of its capacity.
Exactly. Demanding enormous amounts of coronary blood flow just to keep that thick muscle alive.
So here's the critical point for us in the OR. Even small hemodynamic changes.
Yeah, tiny things.
Like a little bit of vasodilation from an induction drug, maybe a sudden drop in heart rate, even just a bit of bleeding.
Things a normal heart wouldn't even notice.
Right. Those can cause this rigid, oxygen-starved engine to just stall catastrophically.
The reserve capacity is essentially zero. That fixed outflow obstruction dictates absolutely everything we do.
Because if the patient can't compensate by pushing out more blood per beat,
we have to meticulously control the variables they are dependent on. And there are three main ones.
Okay, this leads us right to the three non-negotiable perioperative priorities. If listeners take away nothing else today, lock these three pillars in.
These are the foundation for every decision. First, keep the fuel tank filled.
Meaning
maintain adequate preload. That stiff ventricle absolutely depends on high filling pressures to stretch and eject any reasonable amount of blood.
Okay, pillar one, preload. Pillar two.
Keep engine pressure high. This means maintaining diastolic blood pressure. This is priority number one, really, for keeping the heart muscle itself perfused.
Got it. Diastolic pressure for coronary perfusion. And pillar three.
Keep a steady cruise speed. That means a controlled heart rate and critically maintaining sinus rhythm. We're aiming for a pretty narrow window, usually around 60 to 80 beats per minute.
Okay. Preload, diastolic pressure, rate, and rhythm. The big three. Before we unpack those, let's just quickly baseline. What are the key numbers that flag severe AS on that echo report?
Right, the quick red flags. You're looking for an aortic valve area, the AVA, less than 1.0 square centimeter.
Okay, AVA less than 1.0.
Or a mean pressure gradient, the MPG, greater than 40 millimeters of mercury.
MPG over 40.
Or the peak velocity, Vmax, faster than 4.0 meters per second.
Vmax over 4.0, any one of those flags it as severe.
Any one of those. But, and this is huge, what we're about to get into, these numbers can be really misleading if you don't check the patient's flow state.
Okay, so knowing those three headline numbers, AVA, MPG, Vmax, that's just the starting point. We need to understand the whole spectrum, right? Because how we manage things scales dramatically with how severe it is.
Absolutely. Let's lay out the full criteria, starting with the physical bottleneck itself, the aortic valve area, or AVA.
Yeah.
Mild AS, generally not a huge perioperative issue, is anything over 1.5 square centimeters.
Okay, 1.5 is mild.
Moderate AS falls between 1.0 and 1.5 centimeters to space. This is where we start paying closer attention.
1.0 to 1.5 is moderate.
Severe, our main focus today is less than 1.0 centimeters. And then you have critical AS, which is less than 0.6 centimeters to space. Honestly, you rarely see these patients coming for non-cardiac surgery without getting their valve fixed first.
Right. 0.6 is pretty extreme. Okay, that's the area. What about the pressure needed to get through that tight valve, the mean pressure gradient, MPG?
Exactly. MPG tells us how much pressure load that ventricle is fighting against. Mild is less than 20 millimeter HG.
20 mild.
Moderate is 20 to 40 millimeter HG.
20, 40.
And severe, the real red zone, is anything over 40 millimeter HG. The higher that gradient, the harder the heart is working, the more oxygen it needs.
And the less wiggle room you have if coronary perfusion drops.
Precisely. Less tolerance for any kind of hypotension.
Okay. And the last number, Vmax, the speed of that blood jet.
Vmax basically mirrors the gradient. Mild is under 3.0 meters per second.
3.0.
Mild. Moderate is 3.0 to 4.0 meters.
3.0, 4.0 moderate.
And severe is over 4.0 meters.
4.0 severe. So mentally, we should link AVA to the physical opening size and MPG Vmax to the pressure workload and velocity.
That's a great way to think about it. But now we hit that critical caveat, the point where things get tricky. Flow dependence.
Ah, yes. You mentioned we can't just trust the gradient numbers alone. Why not?
Because the gradients MPG and Vmax depend on how much blood the heart is actually pumping forward. If the heart is already weak, maybe from underlying systolic dysfunction or just being really stressed.
So if flow is low?
Then the gradients can look deceptively low, even if the valve itself is anatomically, like, critically tight. This is the trap of low flow, low gradient, severe AS.
Okay. How do we objectively define that low flow state? Is there a number for that?
Yes. We look at the stroke volume index, or SVI. It's the stroke volume adjusted for body size. Flow is considered critically low when the SVI is under 35 milliliters per meter squared.
SVI less than 35 millimeter. So paint the picture on the report. What does that look like?
You might see an AVA of, say, 0.8 centimeter reacher. Mm-hmm. That meets the criteria for severe. But the MPG is only 25 millimeter HG, which looks moderate.
Okay, so mismatch.
Right. But then you look deeper, and the SVI is 30 millimeter account. That patient is much, much sicker than that MPG of 25 suggests. Their heart is barely pumping enough volume to even generate a high gradient across that tight valve.
They're running on fumes.
Exactly. That low SVI completely changes the risk assessment. They have almost no reserve.
Okay, so if we see this low flow, low gradient picture, and the patient is stable pre-op, what's the next diagnostic step? How do we know if it's truly severe AS or something else?
If they're stable enough, the key test is a dobutamine stress echo. We give a low dose of dobutamine.
To gently boost the heart's contractility.
Right, to increase the flow. If that valve is truly anatomically severe, once the flow picks up, the gradient will shoot up maybe past 40, even 50 millimolar HG. That confirms it was true severe AS, just masked by the low flow state.
And if the gradient stays low, even with dobutamine?
Then it's more likely pseudo-severe AS. The primary problem might be more related to the pump function itself, rather than just the valve being the main bottleneck. This distinction is vital for long-term planning, like deciding on valve replacement.
But for us in the OR, handling them for non-cardiac surgery.
Both scenarios, true low-flow severe or pseudo-severe, represent really high-risk patients with minimal reserve. The immediate management principles are very similar.
Okay, let's put this all together into an anesthesia checklist based on the echo. When we open that chart, what are the absolute must-know numbers and what do they mean for our immediate plan?
Right, beyond just the grading, we need to integrate about six key things: AVA, MPG Vmax, SVI, ejection fraction EF, diastolic indices like E, and any notes about prosthetic valves.
Let's start with a hard number. AVA less than 1.0 centimeter eft, what's the immediate implication?
AVA 1.0 means minimal physiological reserve.
Yeah.
Full stop. Your plan immediately includes invasive monitoring. An arterial line is non-negotiable.
Placed when?
Often placed before induction, especially if you anticipate any instability or a tricky airway.
Mm.
And you need vasopressor infusions ready to go, not just drawn up in a syringe, but primed and ready to infuse.
Okay. What about high gradients? MPG over 40 or Vmax over 4.0?
High gradients scream high myocardial oxygen demand. That ventricle is working incredibly hard. Your immediate thought should be, this patient cannot tolerate hypotension or tachycardia.
So obsessive control over MAP and heart rate.
Obsessive is the right word. Ischemia is just waiting to happen if perfusion pressure drops or demand goes up with a fast heart rate.
And if we see that low SVI under 35 millimolar MOF, see the low flow state.
That predicts incredibly poor tolerance to any further reduction in preload, like bleeding or any vasodilation. These patients can crash very quickly.
So the plan?
Readiness for early intracarpic support. We'll talk about dobutamine later. And ideally, having transesophageal echocardiography, TE, available.
Why T specifically?
Because in these low flow states, traditional measures like CVP can be totally misleading. TE lets you directly visualize volume status and contractility to guide your therapy accurately.
Okay, now here's a common misconception I hear. What if the ejection fraction, the EF, looks good, say 60%? Doesn't that mean the patient is relatively stable?
That is probably the most critical error people make in assessing AS risk. Preserved EF does not mean safe, not at all.
Explain that.
If they have that concentric hypertrophy, their ventricle is thick, stiff, and hugely preload dependent. Yes, they haven't failed systolically, yet they can still squeeze well, but their failure mode is diastolic. It's the stiffness.
So you're managing stiffness, not necessarily weakness, even with a good EF.
Exactly. A reduced EF, of course, makes the risk even higher, absolutely catastrophic, often mandating inotropes from the start. But a preserved EF just shifts your focus to managing those filling pressures and, critically, maintaining coronary perfusion to that thick muscle.
Let's drill down on that stiffness. The diastolic indices on the echo, like the E's ratio.
Right.
What does a high E tell us?
A high E is a strong indicator of high left ventricular end diastolic pressure, or LVEDP. Basically, the pressure inside the ventricle at the end of filling is already really high.
And why is that so critical for us?
Because LVEDP is the back pressure fighting against coronary artery perfusion. Remember our perfusion pressure formula?
Mm.
We'll get to that. But high LVEDP makes it much harder to perfuse the heart muscle itself.
So if LVEDP is high, we need to keep the aortic diastolic pressure even higher to compensate.
Precisely. It mandates a proactive vasopressor strategy, usually with something like phenylephrine, to keep that aortic diastolic pressure well above the LVEDP. You can't afford to let it dip.
Okay, one last thing on the echo report. What if the patient has had a valve replacement already, especially a TAVR?
Good point. TAVR patients bring unique risks. The big one is conduction problems. The TAVR valve stent can sit right next to the heart's electrical system.
So, risk of heart block.
High risk of new AV block. You absolutely must have pacing pads on the patient ready to go and be vigilant for it.
Anything else with TAVR valves?
Watch out for paravalvular leak, or PVL. That's leakage around the valve, not through it. A significant PVL can act like aortic regurgitation, lowering effective diastolic pressure, and potentially requiring even higher doses of vasopressors to maintain adequate coronary perfusion.
Okay, we have the echo numbers and their implications. Now let's connect that directly to the heart's actual mechanics using the pressure volume, or PV loop. This really visualizes what's happening with each beat.
The PV loop is fantastic for understanding AS. In a severe AS patient, the loop looks completely different from normal. It's typically very tall.
Representing the high pressure the ventricle has to generate.
Exactly. High systolic pressure needed to force blood through that tight valve.
Mm.
But the loop is also narrow.
Because the stroke volume, the amount ejected, is limited by the fixed obstruction.
Correct. Tall and narrow. High pressure, low output. But the most important part for our management is the diastolic limb, the bottom left part of the loop. In AS, it's incredibly steep.
And that steepness graphically represents the stiffness, the noncompliance of that hypertrophied ventricle?
Precisely. That steep diastolic curve is the stiff ventricle. What it means practically is that to get even a small increase in filling volume preload, the ventricle has to generate a huge increase in filling pressure, the LVEDP.
It doesn't stretch easily.
Not at all. It can't compensate for problems by accepting more volume easily. This is why maintaining adequate filling pressure and a perfect rhythm is so critical. They have no other compensatory mechanisms.
Okay, so if the heart is stiff and needs high preload to function, this brings up a really critical point you alluded to earlier. Why can't we just slam in a liter of fluid rapidly if the patient gets hypotensive? Isn't that the fastest way to boost preload?
That is probably the single most dangerous reflexive action you can take in severe AS. You absolutely must resist the urge to give large, rapid fluid boluses.
Why? What happens?
Because of that steep diastolic PV relationship. That stiff ventricle cannot accommodate a sudden large volume load. If you push fluid in quickly, the LVEDP doesn't just rise, it spikes dramatically.
Okay, and a sudden spike in LVEDP causes?
Two immediate, potentially lethal problems. First, that high pressure backs right up into the pulmonary circulation, causing acute pulmonary edema, flash pulmonary edema. The patient literally drowns.
And second?
Second, and even more immediately dangerous from a cardiac standpoint, that sky-high LVEDP directly crushes your coronary perfusion pressure, your CPP.
Right.
This brings us right back to the absolute core concept here, the diastolic imperative.
Let's state that critical formula again. Everyone needs to have this burned into their brain.
CPP equals aortic diastolic pressure, LVEDP. That's it. Coronary perfusion pressure equals what's pushing blood into the coronaries, aortic diastolic, minus what's pushing back from inside the ventricle, LVEDP.
So in AS, the LVEDP is already high because the ventricle is stiff.
Correct.
So our only real lever to maintain or improve CPP is to aggressively maintain or even elevate the aortic diastolic pressure.
That is the entire game right there.
Yep.
If LVEDP is high and then something happens, say vasodilation from an anesthetic or a regional block, that drops your aortic diastolic pressure.
A CPP plummets.
Instantly. That hypertrophied, oxygen-hungry muscle is suddenly starved of blood flow. Ischemia happens almost immediately.
And that ischemia causes the heart to fail further, leading to more hypotension.
It's a vicious, rapid death spiral. You have to understand that in severe AS, myocardial ischemia usually causes the hemodynamic collapse, not the other way around, which is different from many other cardiac conditions.
Which underscores why maintaining diastolic pressure, often with alpha agonist vasopressors like phenylephrine, is absolutely non-negotiable.
Non-negotiable. Proactive, not reactive.
Okay, so we've covered pressure and volume.
Right.
What about pillar three, rhythm and rate? You mentioned the atrial kick is critical.
Absolutely fundamental. In a normal, compliant heart, the atria contracting just before the ventricle squeezes the atrial kick might contribute, say, 10, maybe 15% of the final ventricular filling volume.
Okay.
But in these stiff, non-compliant ventricles, that atrial kick becomes responsible for maybe 20, even up to 30% or sometimes more of the ventricular preload. It's that final pressure boost needed to adequately stretch that rigid chamber before it contracts.
Wow, 20 to 30%. So losing that synchronized atrial contraction
is catastrophic.
Meaning new onset atrial fibrillation, AFib, is often devastating.
Devastating is the right word. If a patient with severe AS flips into AFib, they instantaneously lose that 20, 30% of their preload. Stroke volume plummets. Blood pressure often crashes immediately.
So the clinical mandate is clear.
Treat new onset AFib in severe AS aggressively and immediately. If the patient is unstable hypotensive, showing signs of ischemia like ST changes, you need to strongly consider synchronized cardioversion right away.
Even before getting cardiology involved.
If they're crashing, yes. Support the blood pressure first with phenylephrine to restore that diastolic pressure, but prepare to shock them back into sinus rhythm. Time is muscle. And in this case, time is also preload.
Okay, and beyond just sinus rhythm, there's the heart rate itself. We need that steady cruise speed.
Right, that narrow therapeutic window. Too fast, say, consistently over 90 beats per minute is really bad.
Why?
Because it dramatically shortens diastolic time. Less time for the ventricle to fill, and crucially, less time for the coronary arteries themselves to get perfused, which happens primarily during diastole. Tachycardia breeds ischemia in AS.
But going too slow is also a problem?
Yes. If the rate drops too low, say below 60, cardiac output falls off. Remember, their stroke volume is relatively fixed by that outflow obstruction. They can't compensate for a slow rate by ejecting more blood per beat.
So cardiac output equals heart rate X fixed stroke volume. If rate drops, output drops.
Exactly. So that target range of 60 to 80 beats per minute is really the sweet spot we're aiming for. Steady sinus rhythm, not too fast, not too slow.
Okay, understanding the physiology, the stiffness, the fixed output, the reliance on preload, diastolic pressure, and rhythm now lets us build the decision framework. When do we proceed with surgery? When do we delay? When do we escalate care?
The patient's symptoms are really the key initial stratifier here. That's the first branch point in the decision tree.
So let's take the first scenario. Elective non-cardiac surgery, but the patient has severe AS and they are symptomatic. They report things like angina, syncope, significant shortness of breath on exertion.
In that scenario, the guideline is pretty clear and evidence-based. Delay the elective surgery. The patient needs valve intervention first.
TAVR or surgical valve replacement, SAVR.
Either one. Fixing the underlying obstruction is the only thing proven to significantly improve their outcomes for the subsequent non-cardiac surgery. Trying to push them through electively without fixing the valve is playing with fire.
Okay, scenario two. Elective surgery, severe AS again. But this time the patient is completely asymptomatic. No angina, no syncope, good exercise tolerance.
This is a bit more nuanced. We still counsel extreme caution. The decision depends heavily on the risk of the planned non-cardiac surgery itself.
Meaning?
If the surgery is intrinsically high risk, think major vascular surgery, big abdominal cases with potential for large fluid shifts or blood loss, then even in an asymptomatic patient, you should strongly consider recommending valve intervention first.
But if the elective surgery is lower risk, say a straightforward hernia repair or something on a limb.
In that case, you may decide to proceed, but only with maximal preparation. That means senior anesthesia staff, full invasive monitoring we discussed, vasopressors ready, TEE potentially available, and a solid ICU plan post-op. You treat them as incredibly fragile, even if asymptomatic.
Okay, moving into the more urgent categories. What about urgent but not immediately life-threatening surgery in a patient with severe AS, symptomatic or asymptomatic?
This requires really close, multidisciplinary discussion surgery, anesthesia, cardiology. The question is, can we safely delay, even for a short period, maybe 24 or 72 hours, to optimize the patient?
Optimize how?
Sometimes, especially in older or very frail patients, a rapid balloon aortic valvuloplasty, BAV, can be done as a bridge. It doesn't fix the valve long term, but it can temporarily reduce the gradient and buy some safety for the urgent surgery. Or increasingly, centers can expedite a TAVR evaluation.
But if delaying even that long poses a significant risk to the patient from their surgical problem, like delaying cancer surgery or an infected source,
then you have to proceed. But you proceed with maximal invasive monitoring, the most experienced team available, full cardiac backup, including potential for mechanical circulatory support in some centers, and everyone acknowledging the significantly increased risk.
And the final category, the true life or death emergency surgery. Massive trauma, ruptured aneurysm.
Life comes first. You proceed immediately. You accept the extremely high perioperative mortality risk.
Anesthetic choices in that crash scenario.
Aim for hemodynamic stability above all else. Etomidate is often the go-to induction agent. Secure the airway, get IV access, and then focus on getting that arterial line in immediately post-intubation if you couldn't pre-induction. Start pressors early and aggressively.
Are there other factors beyond just symptoms and AS severity grade that act as major risk modifiers, pushing us towards being even more cautious?
Definitely. We already touched on them, but to reiterate,
okay.
Any degree of reduced ejection fraction, EF, is a huge red flag. That low SVI, indicating a low flow state, significantly increases risk. Coexisting severe coronary artery disease is obviously additive.
And the post-TAVR patient.
A recent TAVR, especially if associated with a new conduction disturbance like LBBB or heart block, signals increased fragility and demands prophylactic pacing readiness.
Okay, let's make this really concrete. Let's talk surgery type templates. How does the required setup change based on the procedure, assuming we have a patient with known severe AS we've decided to proceed with? Start with minor procedures.
Right. Let's say it's an elective endoscopy, maybe a cystoscopy, or a minor skin procedure. If the patient has severe symptomatic AS.
Even for something minor.
Yes. This cannot be treated like a routine outpatient case in an ASC. It needs to happen in a main operating room setting. You need a mandatory arterial line. You should place external pacing pads prophylactically. And you need a definitive plan for postoperative monitoring, likely in a step-down or ICU setting, depending on how they do. You prepare for the worst, even for minor surgery.
Okay. Intermediate procedures. Things like standard orthopedic joint replacements, general laparoscopic cases like cholecystectomy.
For moderate AS, an arterial line becomes mandatory here. For severe AS, again, ideally you delay if elective, if you must proceed urgently.
The setup.
Full hemodynamic stabilization plan. That often means starting a prophylactic vasopressor infusion, usually phenylephrine, before induction to counteract anticipated anesthetic effects. TE should be readily available if instability occurs. Central venous access should be strongly considered or readily available.
And finally, the major procedures. High-risk vascular surgery, open abdominal or thoracic cases, major neurosurgery.
If it's elective severe AS, the answer is fix the valve first, period. If it's urgent or emergent.
All hands on deck.
Absolutely. This is maximum support, mandatory arterial line and central line access. TE in the room and likely used proactively. Blood bank notified and products immediately available. Temporary transvenous pacing capability should be ready, not just external pads. And this needs to be managed by your most experienced cardiac anesthesia team.
Let's add a specific practical note on laparoscopy, since it's so common. You mentioned the pneumoperitoneum is a stressor.
Huge stressor in AS. It does two bad things simultaneously. It increases systemic vascular resistance, the afterload the already struggling ventricle has to pump against,
making it harder to eject blood.
Right. And it also impedes venous return by increasing intra-abdominal pressure, which can drop preload.
So, management tips for laparoscopy in AS.
Number one, use the lowest effective insufflation pressures, ideally keeping it around 10 to 12 mmHg, definitely avoiding higher pressures like 15 mmHg if possible. Number two, if the MAP drops during insufflation,
don't just reflexively give fluid.
Correct. Your first move should be phenylephrine to directly counteract the increased afterload and support diastolic pressure. Treat the SVR change first. Only give small fluid boluses if you have clear evidence of preload inadequacy, maybe from T or other dynamic measures. Avoid large fluid pushes.
Okay, pharmacology. Every drug choice has to be mapped directly back to that core AS physiology, maintaining preload, diastolic pressure, and that steady heart rate. Let's start with induction agent logic.
This is critical. The induction is often the most dangerous period hemodynamically.
So what's the preferred agent, especially in severe AS or if the patient is already a bit unstable?
Etomidate is generally considered the go-to agent. Its major advantage is remarkable hemodynamic stability.
Why is it stable?
Because it causes minimal vasodilation and has very little myocardial depression compared to other agents. It just doesn't drop the pressure much. The standard dose is usually conservative, around 0.15 to 0.3 milligrams per kilogram.
So Etomidate is the default for stability. When might we think about ketamine?
Low-dose ketamine, maybe 0.25 to 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, has a niche role. It can be useful specifically if the patient is already hypotensive before induction.
Because of its sympathomimetic effects, it supports blood pressure.
Exactly. It can provide some circulatory support, but, and this is a big but, you have to watch the heart rate like a hawk. Ketamine can cause significant tachycardia.
Which we know is bad because it shortens diastolic perfusion time.
Right. So if you use ketamine, you have to be prepared to manage potential tachycardia aggressively, maybe with Esmolol, while ensuring the blood pressure support remains adequate. It's a trade-off.
Okay. And the most common induction agent, propofol. I assume that's generally avoided or used with extreme caution.
Extreme caution is the word. Propofol is inherently risky in severe AS. It's a potent vasodilator.
Drops the SVR and that critical diastolic pressure.
And it's also a myocardial depressant. So it hits you negatively on two fronts. You absolutely must avoid large, rapid boluses.
So if you choose to use propofol,
it has to be titrated very slowly in tiny increments, like 20, 30 milligrams at a time. And ideally, you should have vasopressor support, like a phenylephrine infusion, already running before you even start the propofol to proactively counteract the expected drop in pressure.
Good tip. What about managing the sympathetic surge during laryngoscopy and intubation? That can cause hypertension and tachycardia.
Yeah, that's another danger point. You need to blunt that response. Using adequate doses of opioids like fentanyl or maybe a Reventil infusion during induction is key.
To keep things smooth.
Exactly. And again, if you anticipate any difficulty with the airway or if the patient is very fragile, having that arterial line in pre-induction is invaluable. It allows you to see the pressure response beat by beat and titrate your drugs and pressors precisely.
Okay, induction handled. Now, managing hemodynamics throughout the case. The vasopressor selection matrix. We need the right drug for the specific problem.
Precision is key here. We need to choose the drug that directly fixes the failing variable. Is it low SVR? Is it poor contractility? Is it the heart rate?
We established that maintaining SVR and diastolic pressure is paramount, often the first thing to go. What's the best drug for isolated vasodilation that won't mess up the heart rate?
Phenylephrine. It's the ideal first-line agent for this exact reason. It's a pure alpha-1 agonist,
meaning
it constricts peripheral blood vessels, increasing SVR, and most importantly, directly elevating that aortic diastolic pressure. And crucially, it does this without significantly increasing the heart rate.
So it fixes the pressure problem without causing the tachycardia problem.
Exactly. Boluses of 50 to 100 micrograms are standard, or starting a prophylactic infusion at maybe 20, 50 micrograms per minute can prevent hypotension in the first place. Phenylephrine should be your default pressor for isolated low SVR in AS.
What if the problem isn't just vasodilation? What if there's also a component of reduced pump function? Maybe the EF isn't great, or the SVI is low, and the BP is soft.
That's when you might need norepinephrine. It's often the next step up.
Why norepinephrine?
Because it provides potent alpha-1 vasoconstriction, just like phenylephrine, raising SVR. But it also has some beta-1 agonist activity.
So it gives a bit of contractility support, too.
Exactly. It supports both pressure and, to a lesser extent, pump function. Typical infusion rates are around 0.02 to 0.1 micrograms per kilogram per minute. It's very effective when pure alpha support isn't quite enough.
Any downside compared to phenylephrine?
It does have a slightly higher tendency to increase heart rate due to the beta-1 effect, so you still need to monitor the rate closely. But generally, it's a workhorse drug when both SVR and some contractility support are needed.
Okay. Now, what if the primary problem is poor contractility, low output state, low EF, very low SVI, maybe confirmed with T, showing a poorly squeezing ventricle?
That's the specific indication for an inotrope like dobutamine. Starting dose usually low, maybe 2 to 5 micrograms per kilogram per minute.
But you mentioned this is dangerous in AS.
Extremely dangerous. Dobutamine's primary effect is increasing contractility via beta-1 stimulation, but it also causes beta-2-mediated vasodilation and, critically, can significantly increase heart rate.
So potential for both hypotension and tachycardia.
Yes. It can worsen the exact problems we're trying to avoid. Therefore, if you decide to use dobutamine, it absolutely requires close hemodynamic monitoring, ideally with T guidance.
Why T specifically with dobutamine?
T allows you to directly visualize the effect. Are you actually improving stroke volume, or are you just making the heart beat faster without ejecting more blood, leading to ischemia? You also need to ensure preload and afterload, SVR, are optimized first before adding an inotrope. Dobutamine is a targeted tool for pump failure, not a general resuscitation drug in AS.
Okay, let's talk about maintenance anesthesia. Volatile anesthetics, SIVODES, ISO, they all cause vasodilation, right? Which we know is bad.
They do, in a dose-dependent manner. That vasodilation drops SVR and therefore drops CPP. So the rule is, keep volatile agent concentrations low. Generally, try to stay below 0.8 MSC if possible.
Below 0.8 MSC, that might not be enough anesthesia on its own for surgical stimulus.
Exactly, which is why you need a balanced technique. Rely heavily on opioids for analgesia. Consider regional blocks where appropriate and potentially supplement with other agents.
What about using total intravenous anesthesia, TEVIA, instead of gas? Maybe propofol and remethentanol?
TEVIA is a perfectly acceptable and sometimes even preferred technique in AS, but with a major caveat.
Which is?
You must be able to maintain stable blood pressure. Given propofol's vasodilating properties, using TEVIA often requires having a prophylactic vasopressor infusion, like norepinephrine or phenylephrine, running from the start to maintain that target MAP and diastolic pressure.
So TEVIA is okay, but only if pressure is actively supported.
Correct. The potential benefit is avoiding the baseline vasodilation of volatile agents and allowing perhaps more precise titration. But aggressive multimodal analgesia using nerve blocks, local infiltration, non-opioid systemic analgesics is crucial with either technique to minimize the overall anesthetic requirement and the associated hemodynamic depression.
We've hammered home the need for invasive monitoring. Let's just reiterate the arterial line requirement. When is it absolutely mandatory and when should it go in?
Okay, minimum requirement. Any patient with moderate or severe AS undergoing an intermediate or major risk non-cardiac surgery needs an arterial line. Full stop.
And ideally placed.
Ideally placed pre-induction.
Especially
for severe AS or if you anticipate any hemodynamic swings or airway issues. You need that continuous beat-to-beat blood pressure information before the major physiological trespass of induction and intubation occurs.
Is there anything specific we should look for on the arterial waveform itself that screams severe AS?
Yes, the classic description is pulsus parvus et tardus.
Latin. Break that down.
Parvus means small or weak. So the pulse pressure, the difference between systolic and diastolic, is narrow, reflecting that low, fixed stroke volume.
Okay, small pulse pressure. And TARDIS.
TARDIS means slow or delayed. The upstroke of the arterial waveform is slow and rises gradually, not sharply. This reflects the prolonged time it takes for the ventricle to eject blood through that tight, obstructed valve.
So a weak pulse with a slow rise time, seeing that visually confirms the physiology.
Exactly. It's a physical manifestation of the severe outflow obstruction.
We've mentioned T several times as being available or ideal. When does it cross the line from being a helpful tool to being absolutely essential, maybe even life-saving?
T becomes essential in a few key situations. First, anytime you have unexplained persistent hemodynamic instability despite your initial interventions.
When you don't know why the pressure is low or the output is poor.
Right. TEA can immediately tell you, is the ventricle empty? Needs preload. Is it dilated and failing? Needs inotropy. Is the patient profoundly vasodilated despite pressors? It takes the guesswork out when the stakes are incredibly high.
Other key times for TE.
Definitely when you're considering or using inotropic support like dobutamine, as we discussed, to guide titration and assess the effect on contractility versus heart rate. And it's invaluable in very complex patients, like those with combined valve lesions or poor baseline function, low EF, low SVI.
Okay, we need clear lines in the sand. What are the absolute triggers to escalate care? What physiological signs mean we stop, call for backup like cardiology or CT surgery, and potentially abort the procedure if necessary?
Hard stops include persistent MAP below, say, 65 or 70 mmHg despite escalating vasopressor support and appropriate fluid management. You're losing the battle.
Okay, refractory hypotension. What else?
Any clear sign of ongoing myocardial ischemia on the ECG significant new ST segment depression or elevation? That means the heart muscle is actively dying.
Urgent intervention needed.
Absolutely. Also, the development of new high-grade atrioventricular AV block, especially second-degree Mobitz dissected or third-degree complete heart block. This is particularly concerning in post-TVR patients. That requires immediate pacing and likely cardiology consult.
Got it. Refractory hypotension, new ischemia, new high-grade block. Those are call-for-help moments. Now, let's tackle the really big danger zone, regional anesthesia. Explain again simply the core neuraxial hazard.
The fundamental problem with spinal or epidural anesthesia in severe AS is the unavoidable sympathetic nervous system blockade they cause.
The sympathectomy.
Right. This block leads to two simultaneous disasters.
Yeah.
Widespread vasodilation, dropping SVR and that critical aortic diastolic pressure.
Crashing CPP.
And venous pooling, which reduces preload return to a heart that's already critically dependent on high filling pressures. It's a double hit on the core physiology.
And the fixed output heart cannot compensate for the sudden drop in SVR and preload.
It has no ability to vasoconstrict effectively or increase stroke volume to compensate. The result is often profound, rapid, and potentially irreversible hypotension and cardiovascular collapse.
Given that catastrophic potential, what is the absolute hard and fast rule regarding spinal anesthesia?
Single-shot spinal anesthesia is considered absolutely contraindicated in patients with severe aortic stenosis. The onset of the sympathectomy is too rapid and too deep to manage safely. It's just too dangerous.
No exceptions for spinal?
Essentially, no. The risk far outweighs any potential benefit in severe AS.
Okay, what about epidurals? They have a slower onset. Is there any place for an epidural?
This is a controversial area, and the answer is maybe,
yeah,
but only with extreme caution and in very specific circumstances.
Such as?
It might be considered only in patients with mild or perhaps very carefully selected moderate AS who are completely asymptomatic. And even then, it requires the absolute highest level of vigilance.
Meaning what setup?
Mandatory arterial line placed beforehand. A vasopressor infusion, like phenylephrine, must be running prophylactically before the epidural is even dosed. Dosing must be extremely gradual, tiny increments, maybe 2-3 millimoles at a time, spaced out over many minutes, constantly watching the blood pressure.
So very slow, very careful titration with pressor support already going.
Yes. But honestly, even then, many experts would argue the risk is still too high. The strong preference, whenever feasible for the surgery, like limb surgery, is always peripheral nerve blocks.
Why are peripheral blocks safer?
Because they provide excellent surgical anesthesia and a post-op analgesia for a specific region without causing the systemic hemodynamic collapse associated with neuraxial sympathectomy. They're almost always the preferred regional technique in patients with significant AS.
Okay, final point in this section, fluid strategy. We know preload is critical, but we also know fluid overload is disastrous. How do we walk that tightrope?
It's a constant balancing act. The goal is generally euvolemia, maybe leaning towards slightly high filling pressures, but avoiding overload at all costs.
So how do we give fluids if needed?
The key is small, cautious boluses. Think 250 milliliters, maybe 500 millilevel maximum at a time, then pause. Reassess hemodynamics. See the response. Don't just open the IV fluids wide.
And if the patient is hypotensive, fluid isn't always the first answer.
Absolutely not. You must determine the cause of the hypotension first. If you suspect vasodilation, low SVR, the answer is vasopressors, primarily phenylephrine. Giving large fluid boluses for vasodilation-induced hypotension in a stiff ventricle is a recipe for flash pulmonary edema and worsening CPP. Prioritize pressors over large fluids unless you have clear evidence of hypovolemia.
All right, let's synthesize all this into practical step-by-step crisis management plans. When the monitor alarms, what's the immediate sequence of actions? Let's run through the most common intraoperative nightmares.
Okay, scenario one, profound hypotension right after induction, or maybe during intense surgical stimulation. Likely cause is vasodilation, maybe combined with some myocardial depression.
Action sequence.
Step one, immediate 4V bolus of phenylephrine. 100 to 200 micrograms. Step two, simultaneously start or increase a phenylephrine infusion, maybe 50-100 mg initially. Step three, check your anesthetic depth. Is the volatile agent too high? Can you turn it down?
Okay, pressor bolus, pressor infusion, check anesthetic depth. What about fluids?
Only consider a small fluid challenge, 250 milliliters of crystalloid, if you have a reason to suspect true preload inadequacy, but prioritize restoring SVR first. If the hypotension persists despite phenylephrine,
next step,
switch to or add a norepinephrine infusion to get that extra beta-1 support if needed, and start thinking about TE if the cause remains unclear.
Okay, scenario two. New onset atrial fibrillation appears on the monitor and the blood pressure immediately tanks. You've lost the atrial kick.
Action sequence. Step one, deepen the level of anesthesia slightly if possible to blunt sympathetic drive. Step two, immediate phenylephrine bolus to urgently restore aortic diastolic pressure and CPP while you figure things out. Step three, if the patient is hemodynamically unstable, MAP crashing, ST changes.
Oh, don't hesitate.
Perform synchronized cardioversion immediately. 100, 200 joules biphasic. Restore sinus rhythm ASAP. If they are transiently stable, you could cautiously try a rate-controlling agent like a small dose of Esmolol, but cardioversion is often necessary and definitive. Call cardiology, but act first if unstable.
Got it. Scenario three, severe bradycardia, rate 50-60, accompanied by hypotension, maybe due to high vagal tone or a drug effect.
Action sequence. Step one, immediate atropine 0.5 milligram IV. Repeat if necessary up to 3 milligram total. Step two, if atropine is ineffective or the bradycardia is profound, interjoe complete heart block. Immediately prepare for external pacing. Apply the pads if not already on.
What about blood pressure support during bradycardia?
If the blood pressure is dropping significantly with the slow rate, start a norepinephrine infusion concurrently. It will provide vasoconstriction and some chronotropic support while you address the underlying bradycardia with pacing or further drugs, like epinephrine or dopamine if needed. Have transvenous pacing available if external pacing is required or anticipated to be needed longer term.
Okay, those are great algorithms. To help listeners remember the core principles throughout the case, there's the AS Safe mnemonic. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. As Safe help keep the priorities straight. A is for actual load maintenance. Keep that SVR and diastolic pressure up, primarily with phenylephrine. B, proactive.
Okay, afterload.
S is for sinus rhythm. Absolutely critical for preload via the atrial kick. Treat AFib aggressively.
Sinus rhythm.
The second S is for safe HR. Keep the heart rate in that sweet spot, 60 to 80 BPM. Avoid tachycardia and significant bradycardia.
Safe HR.
The second A is for adequate preload. Maintain filling pressures, but remember the rule. Small, cautious, fluid boluses only.
Adequate preload, carefully.
F is for fixed obstruction. Never forget the underlying physiology. The heart has zero ability to increase stroke volume on demand. No reserve.
Fixed obstruction.
And E is for escalate early. Have a low threshold to call for help. Use TE, involve cardiology, and plan for a higher level of care post-op from the beginning.
As Safe. Afterload, sinus rhythm, safe HR, adequate preload, fixed obstruction, escalate early. Excellent mnemonic. Okay, the surgery's over. What's the minimum required post-operative care and disposition for these patients?
Patients with severe AS, especially after undergoing intermediate or major non-cardiac surgery, require mandatory ICU or step-down unit monitoring for at least 24 to 48 hours post-op.
What monitoring specifically?
At minimum, continuous telemetry to watch for arrhythmias or ischemia, and ideally, continued arterial line monitoring until hemodynamically stable and weaned off pressors. Fluid shifts and delayed decompensation are common in the first day or two. The risk doesn't end when they leave the OR.
What about key medications post-op?
Continue their chronic beta blockers if they were on them. Rate control and reducing myocardial oxygen demand remain vital. ACE inhibitors or ARBs that were held pre-op should only be resumed once the patient is clearly hemodynamically stable and euvolemic, often not until post-op day one or two. Restarting too early risks hypotension.
And for the TAVR patients?
Careful reconciliation of their antiplatelet or anticoagulation regimen is crucial, balancing the valve thrombosis risk against the surgical bleeding risk. This needs clear communication between surgery, anesthesia, and cardiology CT surgery.
Okay, this brings us to our final provocative thought for the listeners. We've successfully managed this high-risk patient through their non-cardiac surgery. We stabilized them, got them through. We won the battle, Rep.
We won the immediate battle, yes. But the patient still has severe aortic stenosis. That underlying fixed outflow obstruction hasn't gone away.
So the war against AS isn't over.
Not at all. We, as perioperative physicians, are excellent acute stabilizers, but we don't cure the underlying disease.
So the challenge for us, perhaps, is how aggressively should we advocate after the surgery for definitive valve therapy? If we identified severe AS, especially if it was symptomatic or caused significant intra-op difficulty, have we done our job if we don't ensure that patient gets plugged into expedited cardiology follow-up for valve intervention?
That's a really important point. We have a responsibility, I think, to ensure that our successful perioperative management isn't just an isolated event, but a bridge to definitive cardiac care. We need to clearly document the severity, the intraoperative course, and strongly recommend timely cardiology evaluation for TAVR or SAVR in our handover and discharge summaries.
To prevent the next engine stall potentially outside the controlled environment of the hospital.
Exactly. Our successful navigation of the non-cardiac surgery should be the catalyst for fixing the primary cardiac problem long-term. Excellent collaboration and communication are key. Hashtag tag tag outro.
All right, let's quickly recap the absolute core takeaways from this deep dive into aortic stenosis management. Remember those three non-negotiable pillars.
Keep the fuel tank full, that's preload.
Yeah.
Keep the engine pressure high, that's diastolic pressure for coronary perfusion, and maintain that steady cruise speed sinus rhythm at 60 to 80 BPM.
For pharmacology, think stability. Etomidate is often preferred for induction.
And phenylephrine is your go-to first-line vasopressor to maintain that critical diastolic pressure without unwanted tachycardia.
And the absolute contraindication.
Single-shot spinal anesthesia in severe AS. Just don't do it. Peripheral nerve blocks are strongly preferred for regional.
Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.